Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Sanjeev Goel here from PQM Labs, and today my guest is Dr. Raghav Sehgal. He's a PhD student at Yale, and he's also one of the world-leading experts in epigenetic clocks. He's developed his own systems of aging clock, and we'll be talking about today, as well as all the history of epigenetic clocks. So I hope you get something useful from this, just like I did, and we'll see you on the other side. Hi, Dr. Sehgal. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me here, Dr. Goel.
I know we met. I want to just give our letter audience kind of know we met, a year and a half ago, I want to say, at the GRC conference. And then we met at another Biomarkers of Aging conference. And I was just so impressed with the research you're doing. And I thought, let's have you on as a guest.
Yeah.
So let's get right into it. Yeah, I think our viewers may want to understand a little bit of the background of how you even got into the space of epigenetic clocks. So maybe, do you want to just take us through a little bit of that? And then let's talk about epigenetic clocks after that.
For sure. So just to give a brief background, I'm a computational biologist by training. So I do a lot of computer science, essentially. And it was just by coincidence, honestly, that I landed into the field of epigenetic clocks and more generally aging. And the coincidence was that I was, one of my friends dragged me to a lecture at Yale to my current mentor, Dr. Morgan Levine's lecture. And I mostly went because there was free food at the lecture. And as a graduate student, it's always good to have free food. And so I just went for the free food, but I was really impressed by her talk. And I decided to rotate in her lab. And that's how I ended up researching on epigenetic clocks and got it into the field of aging. And that's how I've kind of ended up here. And then, of course, we'll talk a lot more about epigenetic clocks and what epigenetics is. But honestly, it all started out with a coincidence, to be honest.
So I'm curious about what was your first impression when you heard about these epigenetic clocks? It must have been that time, I mean, not at that, when you went to that lecture.
Yeah.
This must have been completely new. And I'm just curious about if you could kind of give your impression about it and why it was so important and why you said, hey, you know what, I want to work in this field. Because I think that's what our viewers want. I want them to understand how important a scientific discipline this is.
Yeah, for sure. So prior to sort of being in this field, I was working in discovering new therapies for cancer, right? Mm-hmm. So I was very interested in building new drugs, new therapies for cancer. Mm-hmm. And the way Morgan, Dr. Levine, talked about aging as a field was very interesting. So, and mm-hmm. this is what she propositioned. She said that if we are able to solve aging as a disease, right, we will be able to solve not just aging, we will be able to solve a bunch of other diseases like cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, so on and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest challenges that exists right now about mm-hmm. aging as a disease, or about solving aging as a disease, is to be able to build a good biomarker. Because if you do not have a biomarker for a disease, you cannot measure it, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot measure this disease. And right now, we do not have the best biomarkers out there for aging. And mm-hmm. that's where epigenetic clocks come in. Mm-hmm. Epigenetic clocks are sort of this next generation of biomarkers that can really help measure aging of a person. And they are really what are transforming this field to be able to not just measure how a person is aging, but also help us build the next generation of drugs that can potentially solve aging.
Mm-hmm. So just tell us, before epigenetic clocks, what were these biomarkers of aging that people are using? I mean, we have proxies like chronological age. age is in itself a measure too of aging. And obviously we look at cholesterol levels potentially, or sugar levels. They may be related. They're not.
Yes, exactly. So till prior to epigenetic clocks, right? We were looking at, of course, chronological age, which which of course is related to aging, as we all know, right? Like the number of candles on your last birthday can't tell you how many years you have aged. But there are so many other things that affect aging: the environmental factors, your lifestyle choices, right? Whether you smoke or you're eating healthy, or your genetics, right? You might be predisposed to certain diseases because of your familial history. All of these things affect your aging, which is often not quantified by chronological age, and more so often not quantified by sort of these biomarkers like cholesterol or sort of your HbA1c, which is sort of measured for diabetes, so on and so forth. And so you need sort of more closer molecular biomarkers that are closer to the biology of aging, right? And that's where kind of epigenetics comes in. Epigenetics is closer to the biology of aging in that sense. And that's why we are able to measure aging so much better using these sort of epigenetic aging biomarkers.
And that I guess that presupposes that that epigenetic changes are the are one of the processes of aging, or how aging actually happens is being reflected in epigenetic changes. That you must believe in that type of theory
Yeah,
to believe that epigenetic clocks work.
there are multiple theories out there, of course, right? That one could argue that whether epigenetics is downstream of the processes of aging, or epigenetic regulates aging itself. I think there is, we can argue about which of those hypotheses is necessarily true, but there's no arguing about the fact that epigenetics plays a role, whether it's downstream or upstream. We know for a fact that it is capturing aging in some form and shape, right? Because we do know that it's been shown to be associated with cardiovascular disease outcomes, with diabetes outcomes, with mortality. It's been shown to be associated with a bunch of different diseases, with a bunch of different outcomes at this point, right? And now we are even seeing that it's being potentially associated better than these sort of clinical chemistry biomarkers that are already out there, like cholesterol and so on and so forth, right? Giving us the idea that maybe these molecular biomarkers contain a kind of information that we are able to capture that these sort of clinical chemistry and functional biomarkers have not been able to capture till now, right? Something much more closer to the biology of aging.
And it sounds, I mean, it's quite, I mean, I would say, yeah, these epigenetic mark changes are very related to aging, because we have like very good clocks that approximate basically aging. Like these first generation clocks were very, very accurate with predicting people's age. So we do know that it's definitely related to aging. So yeah, so maybe let's talk about, I mean, we had first generation clocks, and then the second generation, and even third generation with PACE, and now the Omic Age that True Diagnostic is doing. So where has that taken us to, and what are the limitations of those clocks? Like, where do you, because I want to talk again about systems clocks and that you kind of put together. So I want to for let's take our viewer, our audience, on a little tour of what has happened. What's the limitation yet? Why develop a systems age clock if with what we have already?
For sure. So I think let's start with kind of the history of clocks to begin with, right? So in 2011 is kind of when the first predictor of age from epigenetics was built. So I think it's useful to talk about like epigenetics per se here, right? Like, what exactly is epigenetics? And epigenetics is nothing but these are these simple methylation or methyl groups, right, that are added on top of your DNA. And what has been shown is that these methyl groups or methylations are very correlated with age. And we have had some indication of this from about like the 1970s. We have seen information about this from like way back. Papers in 1970s have shown this in mice, but only in 2011 is where we were able to build some kind of a machine learning model in humans, where we took these methylation data from humans and predicted age. And there were just three of these methylation marks from human blood that were able to predict age with about 73% accuracy. And that was pretty good.
Got it.
Right.
Right.
And that kind of led to the boom of kind of the epigenetic clocks, right? And if you think about these methylation marks, these are very interesting in a way. So if you think about if you think about DNA like the recipe of life, right? These methylation marks are the ink with which this recipe of life has been written, right? And over time, this ink kind of starts to fade away, right? And what is really happening is as this ink is really fading away, these machine learning models are really trying to capture how much this ink is fading away,
Got
right?
it. That's a very good analogy, yeah, metaphor.
And by that, you're able to tell, well, if this, how much of this ink has faded away, that much is how you have aged, right? And that is essentially what these clocks are trying to do at the end of the day, right?
Right.
So they're telling you how much this ink has faded away in this recipe of life, right? And that is what essentially these DNA methylation marks are telling you. They are the ink of recipe of life, and the machine learning models are telling you how much they have faded away, right? So 2011, you had the first machine learning model that told you with 73% accuracy that, well, this much the recipe of life has faded away. And that kind of led to a bunch of other clocks being developed, bunch of other machine learning models being developed, which led to the first generation of clocks that were all predicting what we call as chronological age, or just predicting the age of a person. And the basic idea was you're able to predict the age, which is really good. But the interesting point was the deviation from age is what was really interesting. So
Right.
you, for example, you got your chronological age for a person, right? And then the predicted biological age from this clock, right? And so if your predicted biological age from this clock was lower, right? That means that you were aging slower than you should be, right?
Right.
And if your predicted biological age was higher, that means that you were aging faster than you should be. And this aging faster or aging slower was associated with a bunch of different increased or decreased risk of diseases. So if you were
Yeah,
in.
so these things were tied to mortality and morbidity, is what you're saying. Like, it's not just that, okay, you're 2 years younger, that 50.
Exactly.
It actually meant, it actually had some significance here that you would potentially live 2 years longer,
Exactly. That meant that you would
theoretically.
potentially live 2 years longer, or potentially live 2 years shorter, or potentially develop some disease sooner or later, right? But these clocks also had their limitations. They weren't as good, right? Which led to us developing more complicated clocks, right? That were predicting
Right.
chronological age, but they started predicting what we call as mortality. That is time to death. Because chronological age was only, as we said, like chronological age is only so good. It cannot tell you when you're going to die because there are a lot of other factors like your environment, your lifestyle, your genetics, all of which affects your chances of living, of your mortality. But mortality is a much better predictor of biological age. It is actually your biological age in some ways, right?
Right.
So people started predicting biological age, or started predicting mortality. The differences between your biological age and chronological age, which we were just talking about, right? That difference started being associated much better with sort of these outcomes like cardiovascular disease and morbidity, so on and so forth, right? And that kind of led to the second generation of clocks. And now we have like the Gen X clocks, like Dunedin pace, right? Which are not
Yeah.
only just predicting sort of mortality, but rather the pace of aging, right? So
Got it.
instead of predicting mortality at a future point, they're predicting the rate of aging at this particular point in time for an individual, that how fast or slow you're aging at this particular point in time, right? But all of these till now have been focusing on one particular thing, which is whole body aging, right?
Got it.
So you've been focusing on the whole age of your body. But here's the interesting thing. We know for a fact aging doesn't happen at the same level on your whole body. If it did, then we would all be dying of the same disease. We would all be dying the same way, right?
Right.
But that doesn't happen. Some of us
Yeah.
will die of a heart attack. Some of us may die of Alzheimer's. Others will get probably really bad osteoporosis, right? So on and so forth, right? So all of us get very different diseases as we age, right? And we'll die of very different diseases altogether. And which comes to the point that we're probably aging very differently and our organs are aging very differently altogether, right? So maybe what we should probably be measuring is not just our whole body age, but the age of our different organs as well, to really get an insight into how we are aging. And that has kind of led me into developing a new version of the clocks, which I call systems age, right? Which using, again, just whole blood DNA methylation can measure aging in 11 different organs of your body, right? And those organs are like the brain, heart, liver, lung, kidney, musculoskeletal system, so on and so forth.
How did you come across what these 11 systems, organ systems would be? It was just, obviously some of them are just, that makes a lot of sense, but if you
Yeah.
could kind of take us through that.
So thankfully, my mentors are one of them is a general scientist, and the other one is an MD, PhD. And they sort of use their knowledge excessively, their sort of expertise and knowledge to sort of choose some of the most critical systems that we know of responsible in sort of aging. And of course, the other choice we also made here was these systems are some of the ones that sort of degrade the most critically in our body and are responsible for some of the most critical diseases that we face in or with regards to aging. So, for example, as I said, like with the brain, it's cognitive decline, Alzheimer's disease. With musculoskeletal, it's arthritis, osteoporosis. With heart, it's cardiovascular disease, right? With liver, it's all your nephrology and so on and so forth. With kidney, it's chronic kidney disease, so on and so forth. So the choice of sort of these particular systems was mostly based on the fact that these organ systems are the ones that are often the ones that are most affected by aging, and are the ones that have sort of the most prevalent aging-related diseases.
And it does seem that you have to kind of believe that all of these, you're saying that all that the aging is happening, but different, these different systems are aging differently at different speeds in different people.
Yes.
That's basically the, you have to believe in
Yes.
that
Yes.
must be happening.
That well, we not only do we
We have.
believe, I think that we believe is not only true, but we know that for a fact almost, because if that wasn't the case, right, we wouldn't see people experiencing different diseases at different rates altogether.
Yes. So that's okay. Yeah. So this is based on a kind of, it kind of sense because that's what people's clinical picture presents like that. But in
Exactly.
your research, has it all, I'd love to hear a little bit about your research about what is actually showing the results? Like how do people's organ systems, how different are they? And does that match with their clinical picture?
Yeah, that's actually kind of like the beauty of this. So one of the things that we did in our research was, after we sort of made all of these 11 different scores, we, in one of our sort of validation cohort studies of about 5,000 individuals, we clustered these individuals in like a very unsupervised approach, just based on these system scores, right? So we didn't do anything, we just clustered them just based on their system scores. And we found there were 9 different groups of individuals that were aging in like very different ways, right? Now, these 9 different groups of individuals were aging in very different ways, right? And they got diseases at very different rates. They had very different disease occurrences that were happening, right? Some of them were getting cardiovascular disease. Some of them were getting, had like increased lung cancer. Some of them had increased diabetes. And all of them were sort of associated. For example, the individual had who had increased diabetes showed increased aging in their metabolic and inflammatory, this thing, sort of system. The who had cardiovascular disease showed increased sort of cardio, sort of CBD, sort of a heart score. Well, what's interesting is we also saw some very interesting relationships as well. For example, there were 2 groups that had increased risk of developing cardiovascular disease, or 2 clusters of individuals that had increased risk of developing cardiovascular disease. Both of the groups had increased heart scores, right? But one of those groups had an increased lung score, right? And we later on also saw that these were, this group was also had an excess number of smokers, which makes sense why they had an increased risk of developing cardiovascular disease. While the other group had an increased metabolic score and an inflammatory score, right? And was also a group which had an increased number of obese individuals. So these are 2 groups that are theoretically both going to get cardiovascular disease, right? And this was
by different mechanisms,
but by different mechanisms altogether, but they're probably going to be treated the same way in clinic,
right?
But maybe, just maybe, they should not be, because their aging mechanisms are very, very different.
That's very interesting. So how many of these aging mechanisms were you able to elucidate?
Well, at this point, this is a very relatively small cohort study of 5,000 individuals, right? We need much bigger cohort studies to elucidate this. At this point, we were able to look at only 9 such different aging clusters. I believe there are potentially more, right? But at least 9 exist, in my opinion. And as we look at more individuals, we probably find more such clusters. But
so
in
they might even point to underlying processes of aging.
Yes, potentially.
This is very interesting.
And potentially the idea is, not only will they point at underlying processes of aging, I think there's also very interesting ideas for therapeutic potential here, right? If you fall in a certain category or a certain cluster, right, you should be treated in a specific way with a certain type of therapeutics. It's almost patient stratification, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay. So I'm just curious about things like alcohol use and liver health, things like that. Were you able to see any of that, any impact?
So we do see that, for example, the liver score has been associated with alcohol dependence or increased alcohol use. So individuals who have increased amount of alcohol use seem to be aging much more swiftly on the alcohol in the liver score. One interesting study that we did do an analysis on recently was quite interesting, actually. So we saw the study where we were looking at individuals who were deployed in the military to Afghanistan. And so we're looking at data pre-deployment and then post-deployment. And we had, and what we saw was that these individuals post-deployment, we had multiple time points post-deployment, they were suffering through PTSD. And unfortunately, because of PTSD, they had an increased alcohol dependence. And that increased alcohol dependence translated clearly to an increased aging in their liver, and a rather significant increase in their aging liver, almost a 1.3-year increase over a 6-month period.
It's almost like 2 or 3 times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's even more interesting is not only was it affecting their liver, it was also affecting their inflammatory score and their heart score, where they saw about from 1 month post-deployment to 6 months post-deployment, there was about a 1-year increase in their inflammatory score, and mm-hmm. their heart score increased about 0.9 years mm-hmm. in 1 month to 6 month period.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, there are effects of sort of something like alcohol dependence on sort of not just the liver, but other parts of the body as well.
Right. How tied were these to actual chronologic age? Like, for example, could a 70-year-old man have a 20-year-old liver and a 50-year-old muscles? I mean, is this very possible? I mean, is that how much variation was there?
So when we do any of these analysis, we regress out chronological age. So we are only looking at the variation from their basal chronological age. So this is above and beyond chronological age, right? So any of these changes are above and beyond chronological age, right? So again, like the error, as I was telling you about. So the difference mm-hmm. between the biological age and chronological age.
Like, how big is that? That's my question is that how much is related to just life, and how much is related to that can vary because of, let's say, alcohol use. Like, can somebody who's 70 years old have a 20-year-old liver if they didn't drink alcohol? Like, is that possible? Or is it just that the process of aging puts everyone within a 5-year range? Like, it's not very modifiable.
Well,
I'm just curious.
Increase. The point is that if you increase your alcohol consumption, right, it will increase your alcohol. It will age your liver, right?
Yes.
And that is an irreversible change, right?
Yes. And I'm just, how big is that? It looks like it was very big in those 6 months. I'm just curious how big is that? And will your clock show that?
It would potentially be quite big, right? And in this case, I would say that the alcohol, I would say this was an extremity, because mm-hmm. these are individuals who are potentially in a very stressful scenario consuming excessive amounts of alcohol. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not individuals, I would say, who are consuming one beer a day. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There are individuals consuming significant amount of alcohol.
Got it. So, I mean, one of the values of biomarker that should be reversible with treatment or something. So how are these changes in the clock, or how changeable are they?
Very, very much changeable. And that's the exciting part. Right. So not only are these clocks sort of, do they go up if you do bad things or like consume excess alcohol or smoke or something like that, but they also go down if you have practiced good things or have aging interventions, healthy aging interventions. So for example, good diet, right? So in a recent study, we actually in multiple different studies recently, actually, we have looked at different types of diet. We've looked at a vegan diet. We have looked at a low-fat diet. We've looked at a Mediterranean diet. We have looked at exercise. So different lifestyle interventions. And across the board, we have seen specific organ systems changing. Right. So, and the ones we would very much expect. So the metabolic organ system, like the metabolic system going down, the inflammatory system going down, the cardiovascular or the heart score going down, right? The musculoskeletal system becoming better, all of them becoming better. And these are over, like, these are studies which were done where typically the intervention is run from anywhere between a couple of weeks, means like 2 to 3 months, all the way to a couple of years, so 1.5 years. So we're looking at from a few months to a couple of years, we are seeing a decent amount of range of these interventions. And we're seeing like very sort of robust results across the board that these clocks are reversible. And we're seeing these clocks being reversible by just lifestyle interventions. And not just lifestyle interventions, we are seeing these clocks being reversible by medicine-based or even sort of more, as I say, interventions like plasmapheresis-based interventions, where so there's a study where a very controversial study that was done a couple of years ago, where plasma from sort of the umbilical cord of umbilical cord was taken and injected into really old individuals, and somehow that rejuvenated them, at least for these whole body clocks. And we see that very specific systems are being rejuvenated as well in our data, or at least in with our clocks as
Oh,
well.
wow. That's very interesting. Because so, is there any particular systems that I got, or was it a whole body, many of different organs with
No.
plasma free?
Systems are being rejuvenated, it seems. So this data, we're yet to publish it, which is why I'm not talking much
Okay.
about
Okay.
it
Yeah.
now.
Understandable. I understand.
But we are seeing these results, but we're also seeing results with supplemental data, right? So supplements, I would say, are the weakest form of interventions, in my opinion, right? So
Anything out there that strikes you that you could tell our listeners and viewers, like what type of supplements have shown any type of effect on epigenetic clocks?
we have seen like very, very weak sort of associations, and I'm seeing very, very weak associations with vitamin B12 and folate at this point. But again, these are very weak associations, and I would not necessarily recommend them. I think the jury is still out on that. I would say better interventions are probably lifestyle-based interventions like diet and exercise, in my opinion.
So when we talk, let's dive a little deeper on the diet, because it's what you sounded like. Just a healthy diet made an impact. But is there any way to differentiate, let's say, a vegan versus a Mediterranean diet? Like,
Yeah, for
is there
sure.
any difference in the results?
Yeah, so I think it seems like, at least from the preliminary analysis that we have been doing, that the vegan and low-fat diet seem to have a much bigger impact on at least the epigenetic clocks in reversing aging than the Mediterranean diet has had. We don't necessarily know the reason why that might be the case. It could potentially be that maybe the Mediterranean diet does have some more components of meat. You still eat fish in the Mediterranean diet, which you're still avoiding a little more in the low-fat diet and the vegan diet, of course.
What
So,
about the keto or low carb? Is there anybody looked at that?
we don't have data on the low-carb diet yet. So we don't know that yet, I'll be honest. But maybe we might see something interesting there. So I don't know for a fact. But it'll be interesting to check that out. But yeah, so there is a lot, I think there's a lot to be seen around diets. And I think, but over, I think across the board, in my opinion, there is a decent amount of interventions that are showing that in general, diets are improving epigenetic clocks to different extent. And I think one odd study will not give us the final answer on which diet is the best to slow down your aging. But I would say that in general, if you're doing a diet of any kind at this point, you're probably slowing down one of some of your epigenetic clocks.
What about, I mean, one might argue that I hear people all the time say, you know what, like for me, this diet works, like it suits me. I can only eat low carb, or I can only eat vegan, or whatever. It's based on my body type, and I'm sure their genetic fact. Everyone's different. We talk about a personalized recommendation based on a person's genetic makeup. So I'm just curious that any of these studies looked at like specific cluster, like who responded better, or like is your baseline aging of your, let's say, your metabolic health going to impact which diet is better for you?
Unfortunately, no. At this point, we have not really looked at sort of individual sort of level data where we have seen that how sort of baseline data might potentially affect how your outcomes might be for a particular intervention. And I think that in itself is really interesting potential follow-up. And I would argue that in that scenario, that That is something that needs to be looked at very in a lot of detail. Unfortunately, a lot of these diet interventions are in the more order of magnitude of hundreds and not sort of thousands. So the kind of analysis that we are really looking to do would require thousands of individuals and not sort of maybe like 200 individuals like we have in these studies. But the good thing, as I said, is like as far as you're practicing a diet that you feel comfortable with, right, you are probably improving your health, right? You're probably decreasing your epigenetic age, right? The magnitude of, I think the question is, what is the magnitude of it, right? I think that is probably something that is going to be experimental, and that will probably be something that you will have to customize a little bit based on your own trial and error, and probably work with your personal doctor with that. And that's where probably you, Dr. Goyal, can come in. But I think beyond that, I think as far as there is a diet and exercise component, right? I would say that the epigenetic clocks will probably be reversed.
Yeah. It sounds to me that what I want the viewer to take away from this is that we have pretty good evidence that diet is an important factor, like
Yeah.
in aging. That's what you're basically telling me, that these things do make an impact. So I think viewers need to listen. Hey, that you just diet and exercise are proven to slow down aging.
Yes. Yes.
And so that's in itself important.
Yes, and
Now,
I think
whether that
that is
diet
very
is,
critical.
yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm saying that in itself is very critical. These are things we already know to some extent, and I think these are further validated. What's even more important is, I think, is to work to sort of is to see what works best for you, right? In terms of not just, hey, is this making me lose the most weight, but is this something that I can abide by the most? It doesn't make sense to be on a diet that you don't feel the most comfortable with. Like, I try to be on diets that make me feel miserable, and I don't think I will ever be able to follow a diet like that, right? Or be on an exercise routine that I cannot follow for more than a week, right? That's just my personal opinion, I
It's
guess.
kind of a long game. That really brings me to the question of how have you incorporated this knowledge now that you more than anybody else about aging, about have incorporated into your own life? Like, how does this impact what you do in your day to day?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that point, right? Like it's a long game, right? It needs to be it's a marathon. So it needs to be small things that you can do on a daily basis, right? If I can't go for a high intensity workout today, right? That's okay. I'll probably sit at home and do maybe a 30-minute yoga session, right? I'll maybe do 15 push-ups. I'll do some kind of physical exercise. Right? Anything matters, right? Something matters, right? Don't need to be in a gym to be crunching weights to do significant amount of exercise, right?
Yeah,
You
and
can.
what is the data on that? I'm just curious. People may ask me, hey, what do we have any data on high intensity exercise and longevity
We
and
were
epigenetic changes?
Yeah, so we're actually working on an analysis where we're looking at high intensity workouts and how that changes epigenetic age. So we don't have results yet, but hopefully very soon. But I think, as I said, any kind of physical activity, right, done for maybe 30 minutes to 45 minutes a day is helpful.
I understand that the systems clock is going to be available to customers of True Diagnostic. Anywhere else it's going to be available, or is that's where
No,
the
at this
business
point,
does
it's
stuff?
mostly going to be available through diagnostics. Hopefully, in the next month or so, fingers crossed, we'll see. Yeah, excited to have it available to customers. And yeah.
Thank you. And what's your plan for, what are the big challenges for you next 6, 12 months? What are you working on? What do you think?
I'm really looking
Big
forward.
projects?
Yeah, some of the things that I'm really looking forward to is like getting out a lot of the things that I've been working on are around like showing and seeing how system scores, the system clocks are changing with different interventions, right? Like interventions like supplements, lifestyle, pharmacological, plasmapheresis, right? And not just interventions, but also sort of accelerated aging events, right? Like chemotherapy or surgery or something psychosocial, right?
Sure.
Both the good and the bad. And so just seeing how all of these can change aging in your organs, and can we really understand something better about the biology of aging by looking at all of this data together?
All right. Well, thank you so much, Raghav. I really appreciate it.
Thank
Appreciate the
you.
time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Goel. Have a great
All
day.
right. Okay.
Hi everyone, Dr. Goyal here. I hope you enjoyed today's talk with Dr. Sehgal. It was quite informative, and please like and subscribe for this video so we can get the word out to more people. Take care.